of rain developing from the middle of the morning. Dry and bright though in eastern Scotland, clouding over later with some rain possible into the afternoon, highs of 11 to 15 degrees. And finally for Wednesday, it will stay unsettled with rain at times, wind increasing, best of the sunshine again in eastern England and feeling warm. That's your weather.
Thank you. This is BBC Radio 4. Now our new book of the week, An Englishman Abroad Discovering France in a Rowing Boat. Charles Timoney lives in France with his French wife, Inès. Having spent 6 months building a rowing boat from kit and urged on by friends, he bets them that he will travel the entire length of the River Seine, from its source to the sea, in an attempt to discover the true France. He'll use his homemade rowing boat where he can. Mark Heap is the reader.
The Seine might be a well-known river, but faced with the task of exploring it in its entirety, I could see that I needed some sort of a plan. It is a long river, about 470 miles long, far longer than any in the UK, twice the length of the Severn or the Thames. Further research showed that the source lies somewhere in Burgundy, a good three-hour drive to the southeast of our house, and the Seine eventually reaches the English Channel at Le Havre. While everyone knows that the Seine flows through Paris, it seems that people are less sure about where it comes from or where it goes afterwards. I can say this with a fair degree of confidence, because part of my research for the quest involved giving French people a blank map of France and asking them to trace the course of the river. My simple request provoked a wide range of reactions. Several of the people I asked went to pieces right from the outset and simply drew a vague, squiggly line across the top half of the country. The left-hand end of their lines entered the sea in a huge range of locations anywhere from Bordeaux to Dieppe. It seems hard to explain inaccuracy on so spectacular a scale because the Seine, once it leaves Paris, is anything but inconspicuous. It is a couple of hundred metres wide. It is a big river. So, what about the bit before Paris? Where does the Seine actually come from? That seemed troublesome for everyone that I asked. I was offered Seines with their source in Dunkirk, and others that doubled back and headed purposefully towards Orléans, or even all the way down to Tours. Very few people indeed got it anywhere near right. The first thing that struck me from the map was how bendy the river was. While you could argue that rowing down a dead straight river might become a bit boring after a while, the presence of so many bends was going to make the river journey far, far longer than might be expected from just measuring the direct distance from the source to the sea. The river could be broken down into three distinct sections: from the source to Paris, the Paris area, and the stretch from Paris to the sea. And with that, I had a plan. I would do the journey in the three stages, using the rowing boat wherever possible and other means of transport, assuming that I found them, for the rest. Clearly, the stretch from the source towards Paris, the part that would most likely involve using the boat, couldn't really be done on my own. I was going to need help getting the boat in and out of the car. A bit of moral support would also probably be much appreciated, and someone to sort out any problems that might arise with the locals. In short, a supportive sort of person who speaks French like a native. "How would you fancy a few days in Burgundy?" I asked Inès. I have come to appreciate that it isn't always easy for a charming and well-brought-up French woman to endure married life with an Englishman. However, in Inès's well-honed search for a peaceful life, she has learned to put up with her husband's occasional moments of extreme Englishness, and indeed can often turn them to her advantage. On learning that her husband was planning to spend most of his free time for the foreseeable future travelling the length of a sizeable river, Inès's reaction was, "At least when he has a goal in life, he's usually in a better mood." Being only 7 feet long, the boat is small enough and light enough to fit easily on a car roof rack, assuming we actually had one. Unfortunately, we don't. Luckily, I was able to borrow a brand new people carrier from work, into which the boat just fitted. A 4-hour drive down a long stretch of the A5 motorway found us in the middle of nowhere, with no water to be seen, not even a bucketful. The source of the Seine lies near the main road that heads south from the town of Châtillon-sur-Seine. We would have missed it altogether had we not caught sight of a small sign that read simply, Site des Sources. There didn't seem to be any other signs anywhere, so we just wandered vaguely around until we stumbled across the information booth. This proved to be something of a disappointment. It was nothing more than a plain garden shed. There was a notice board fixed to the shed wall, but it didn't actually have any notices on it. A rough path near the shed led away towards a small meadow. We could just make out, from the occasional glint of water and the presence of a few reeds, that the centre stretch of the meadow was possibly a tiny bit damper than the rest of it. At the far end, there was what appeared to be a cave. It was a cross between a Victorian folly and a grotto, and it housed a statue of a reclining female figure. For a simple, weathered limestone statue, she really was surprisingly pretty. And, more importantly, there was water. At last! The statue's head was turned to look down into the small pool below her. At first glance, the water appeared quite still, but after a while, I noticed that it occasionally bubbled fitfully like a defective jacuzzi. This feeble bubbling was seemingly the source that we'd come all this way to see, for the statue was that of Sequana, the Roman goddess of the Seine. I had somehow assumed that at most a couple of kilometres downstream from its source, the Seine would be wide enough for me to row on, and that the boat could be launched without too many problems. What's more, I had imagined that once on the water, I would be free to row a few kilometres downriver before being picked up in the car at a prearranged spot by Ines in her role as support crew, and then being whisked off for a reviving drink or a meal somewhere. But it wasn't like that at all. From the source to Châtillon-sur-Seine, a good 50 kilometres downstream, the river is hardly ever wide enough to launch a boat on, let alone row on. So, rather than a young river which I could explore in the boat, what we followed down to Châtillon was more a large stream, fast-moving in places, sluggish in others. Even though it wasn't possible to row on the stretch of the river near the source, the first day wasn't completely wasted, because we did encounter a vastly superior breed of lavoir. In our village, there's a carefully preserved lavoir, an old-fashioned outdoor laundry. Almost up until the Second World War, the washing was done by the ladies of the village, who squatted down and dunked the clothes in the stream that even now flows down a channel in the middle of the floor. The first one we saw near the source of the Seine was so impressive, I thought it was a well-preserved Roman villa. Made of weathered golden stone, it is a sizeable structure which has 6 classical-looking pillars that form an open front. The roof, covered in dark red terracotta tiles, is supported by a complex array of oak beams. A low wall across the front of the lavoir has a short but formal flight of stairs leading down to a rectangular washing area. There are well-tended flower beds all around the walls and a splendid bronze statue of a swan stretching its wings set in the middle of the front. The building dates from 1854 and is fed by 2 streams, the Touché and the Savonneau. Nearer the source is the hamlet of Courceau, which has the first lavoir watered by the Seine on its journey north. This is a proud boast that I'm forced to make on its behalf, because no one in the village apparently thinks that this is important enough to deserve a mention. a short distance away, on what looked like a school sports field, we could see a crowd of people milling slowly about. I sniffed the air, then checked my watch. 11:30. Oh, look, there's a brocante just over there. Do you think we have time for a quick look? Inès sniffed the air suspiciously, checked her watch, gave me what can only be described as an old-fashioned look, and reluctantly agreed. A brocante is a French jumble sale, where the goods on offer are set out on lines of trestle tables. Clearly, many of the things for sale will be typically French, notably books and magazines, as well as 60s and 70s pop records featuring French artists that are probably not everyone's cup of tea. The bande dessinée, cartoon books, are sometimes a much better bet. You can often find well-cared-for examples of Tintin, Asterix or Lucky Luke books at knockdown prices. The general jumble will be much the same as it is anywhere else. So, why my enthusiasm for going to wander round a brocante in an unfamiliar village when there was nothing that we especially wanted? The answer lies in the smell of grilling meat that I had picked up on the wind. Where there is a brocante, there is almost always a stall in a corner somewhere selling merguez. Merguez are long, thin, spicy sausages that are best cooked on a grill. Any self-respecting brocante will have a large grill set out over glowing coals, or at a pinch, over a gas burner, with a shifty-looking chap in a bright T-shirt standing nearby, periodically turning over an array of sausages. At an adjacent table, an acolyte will be chopping baguettes into lengths and splitting them along one edge. Beside him, there should be either a proper drinks cooler, or, failing that, a plastic dustbin with cans of beer and soft drinks chilling in iced water. If it is a really sophisticated operation, there will be beer on tap and a chip fryer. Plastic tubes of ketchup and mustard should also be scattered about within easy reach. Few things on earth, or perhaps few things that you can eat while standing in a French field with a jumble sale going on around you, can be better than a well-grilled merguez in a length of baguette washed down by a plastic glassful of gassy beer. Trust me, things really don't get much better than that. With the boat bone dry in the back of the car, we found ourselves in Châtillon-sur-Seine, where we had booked a hotel for a few days. As the Seine forms a whole third of the name of Châtillon-sur-Seine, one could be forgiven for assuming that it must feature prominently in the lives of the inhabitants. But we quickly realised that the locals hardly seem to be aware of the Seine at all. For a start, despite the fact that the river traverses the entire town centre, you can't really see it. It's either underground or flows through a gully which lies well below eye level. The river here is only a few metres wide and about 15 centimetres deep. We discovered that another reason why the Châtillonnais don't take much notice of the Seine is because it is upstaged by its local cousin, the Douy, a river that rises in the middle of the town. The Douy bursts forth from its source in a cave with surprising, unsane-like enthusiasm. 50 metres from the cave mouth, the river is already 10 metres wide and flowing purposefully. After 100 yards or so, it encounters the Seine. And that, for our friend the Douy, is that. The Seine, however, benefits considerably and leaves Châtillon a much deeper and broader river than when it arrived.
Episode 1 of An Englishman Abroad, Discovering France in a Rowing Boat by Charles Timoney, was read by Mark Heap, abridged by Libby Spurrier and produced by Joanna Green. It's a peer production for BBC Radio 4.